This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
I have 1,000 shiurim shortly. It'll start up with about 400 shiurim of mine. And I want to keep it current, obviously. I want there to be current things. So part of the purpose of the series of shiurim that I'm doing at the moment is not just for the people who are here, but also to make it available to a much wider audience of people as well. So we're doing, there's a double mitzvah in the learning. We're learning together, but in addition to that, we're facilitating a much wider accessibility of the learning that we're doing.
So ask
good questions. You can be recorded for posterity. You can show to your grandchildren one day, you know, your plan said, that was me in the shoe, that question, that was me. And your grandchildren will say, I can't believe Grandpa you asked a dumb question. You got it hated, didn't you know the answer to that one? So that's how that will work. And I've chosen a piece of Gemara, and we'll see how far we get it in the time that we have available. And what we're trying to do is really a very unusual experiment, and I don't know if it's really been done before. And that is, I'm taking a piece of Gemara that is kind of the most irrelevant in quotation marks piece of Gemara that you can imagine. So firstly, we're dealing with kosher, we're dealing with temple service stuff. We're not dealing with all the frum stuff like Yom Tov and Shabbos and Brachos. We're not doing that. We're not dealing with all the fun stuff like damages, Nezikin, Bava Kama, Bava Metzia, Bava Basra. We're not doing that. We're not dealing with all the relationship stuff like Gittin and Kiddushin and Ksubis. We're not dealing with that. We're dealing with Avodah. We're dealing with the temple service. So one would imagine that of all the areas of Shas, this is one of the least relevant in a modern setting. And what we're going to try and do is take a piece of Gemara from Kosher, and I chose this quite randomly, in fact, because the first time we planned, you'll remember we planned to have this year, I think it was last November before I went away in October, and it didn't work out. So at that time, this was just a piece of Gemara I was busy with, that's what I was holding, so that's why I chose it. I didn't choose it for any other reason, but it's really an attempt to see how much take-home value can we gain from a very obscure piece of Gemara. And that should serve as an example of how to learn Gemara. Not so much how to learn Gemara from the skills of analyzing a piece of Gemara. Thank God today there are hundreds and hundreds of very competent Magidei Shir who are giving shiurim and teaching the skills of how to analyze a piece of Gemara. What is being done much more rarely is how to find the underlying principles in a piece of Gemara that can change your life and change the way you think and the way you see. And the second thing is, even more than that, really the skills of linking in, of interfacing the deep philosophic principles with the longest, with the technical and analytical side of it, and actually seeing how they work together. So that's what I want to try and do, and I want us to just have fun with this Gemara. You've got to be able to just... It's very strange. Gemara is a very serious study, but you only really get good at it when you have fun with it.
If you can make this fun, you're an artist, not Parel. I mean, no one can match
it. Okay, well, I'm going to let you into a little secret. I did a trial run on this already. Okay. I did a trial run on this in South Africa, which I didn't record. Unfortunately, it turned out that it was a trial run, and I wasn't that confident in it. But I did a trial run. We'll take a different, slightly different angle, a different group of people. But that was a group of people ranging from people who've never seen the inside of a Gemara before to Rabboni, who were at that shiur. And we had a lot of fun. We had a lot of fun, and it was very, very mind-changing. So the chances are that we're going to pull this off. So let's give it a try. But we've got to be patient. We're not going to put it off in the first shiur. It's going to take a few shiurim before we really start playing with it. But the important thing is to have fun. The important thing is to understand that playfulness is one of the most important dynamics in a creative process. And the Gemara says that the Rebbeinu plays every day. But Rabbi Shem gets up at a certain time, so to say, gets up in the morning, says a brot, and plays with Levi Yosson. Now, we don't know what that means, but we do know that whatever it means, the Gemara is giving us a message that there is a place for playfulness. And unfortunately, Yiddishkeit has become, certainly in recent times, such a, in many cases, not always, but a very oppressive, heavy, serious business, which it is. But seriousness and play are not contradictory. And the human being has to be able to manage that paradox. Seriousness and kalus, there's such a thing in Torah we call kalus rosh, you have lightheadedness. That contradicts Torah. That contradicts seriousness. You cannot be serious and calm. But lesachek, the ability to play in a relationship, a husband and wife to play with each other, a parent and child to play with each other, two friends to play with each other, and to play with ideas. We're losing that capacity. We're getting so oppressed and so serious that we're losing the capacity to play with ideas. And you play with an idea means you take risks. What does a child do when a child plays? And why can a child do things that the child, you know, the famous story of the classroom that you walk into of 5 or 6 year old kids and or even younger, and you ask how many of you can draw and how many of you can paint and how many of you can sing and how many of you can act, and they all put up their hands. And you take the same class a little bit later. My daughter's head told me, in fact, they did this in Australia when she was there for a youth program. They actually filmed the class when they were 4 or 5 years old, and now these kids were 10th or 11th graders, and they asked them the same question. They went to the class and they said, how many of you can sing? One person put up their hands. How many of you can paint? 2 people put up their hands. How many of you can connect? Nobody put up their hands. And then they showed them the movie of that same class, whatever it was, 12 years earlier. And you saw all the kids putting up their hands. And then they said, what's happened to you guys? When did you forget how to do all this stuff? You started, is that what happened at school? You came to school knowing all these things, and 10 years later or 12 years later, you don't know them anymore. So what has this been about? And our educational system does that. As we put in layer of civilization, we actually remove layer and layer of spontaneity.
But isn't that just self-awareness? You know, eventually you go to the museum, you see one of Rembrandt's portraits, and then you go back, look at the one your mother hung on the refrigerator.
And you say there's a difference.
Yeah. When you're 4 years old, you don't recognize that.
But it would be great if one was able to say, I'm not a Rembrandt, and my paintings aren't for anybody else to see. I don't paint to sell or to... Paintings are for me. And the same as I loved doing it when I was 5, I love doing it when I'm 20. Just because it's a form of expression and playing with color. I once got a Hanukkah gift, and the gift was, you'll see how all this has to do with culture in a while. The gift was 8 boxes. It was a very beautiful gift. I got 8 boxes, obviously, for each night Hanukkah. It was for a non-Jewish person. And in each box, there was a different part of a painter's set. So I called this person afterwards, and a woman who I'd helped on a couple of things, and I'd said, I think you've got the wrong person. There's no, I don't paint. So she said, well, why don't you start? So I said, well, I don't know how to. And she said, I said, you know, there's no instruction book. She said, I thought of giving you a book. And then I said, no, because if I get you a book, then you're back in your head. Why don't you just play with the colors? And that was one of the first times I started exploring that idea of just playing with colors, playing with ideas. We don't play. And if you don't play, you don't create. You're not innovative. It's out of the playfulness that new ideas come. So you've got to be willing to go down a track. We'll try things in the Gemara. They might not work. We'll have to backtrack and say, it's a nice idea, but, you know, it doesn't work in the Rashi, it doesn't work in the Tosfos, it doesn't work in the Rambam, it doesn't work in the Gemara itself, so let's go back. Kids do that when they play. They try things, and it doesn't work, then they fix it, or they go back, or they throw it out and start again. That's how you get, if you're absolutely insistent on everything being according to the book, will come out according to the book, but not with any kind of new understanding or new ideas. So in this process of learning, what's really important is that we play with the ideas and see where that leads us. Again, emphasizing the difference between playfulness and kalus. We want playfulness, we don't want kalus. And the next thing to understand is in Gemara altogether, and that there are a number of skills that you need, and we'll talk about them. Humor is one. You've got to have humor. If you can't look at a piece of Gemara and realize, this is so odd, this is so absurd, then you don't begin the whole relationship with those notions. So you need a sense of humor. You need objectivity. There are all sorts of interesting things that you need as you go into Gemara. But one of them is Perhaps one of the most important skills is this is what we call the skill of conceptualization. And that means to understand that when the Gemara talks about an object, it doesn't mean that object. So when the Gemara in the beginning of Bava Kamma talks about a shor, it's not talking about an ox. It's talking about a concept. When it talks about shame, it's not talking about a tooth. It's talking about a concept. It talks about bor, it's talking not about a pit, it's talking about a concept. When the Gemara in Chulin talks about a koved, a liver, or a rea, a lung, it's not talking about a lung or a rea. It's talking about that, but it's talking about so much more. And the way of dealing with them is you work with them conceptually. You don't work with them as objects. You work with them conceptually. If you work with them as objects, you're very limited. You've got to work with them as concepts. Now, we kind of understand that in a lot of areas. Because that's part of the role of fantasy, believe it or not. And I think that fantasy has a lot, an important role in coaching. Now, fantasy, by fantasy, I don't mean something that isn't real. I don't mean something that isn't, doesn't exist. But when you call a concept a shor, that's fantasy. It's a shor shenogach es hapora. An ox gored a cow. Is that Gemara really only for farmers whose oxen gore cows? And you picture it, there's an ox goring a cow. It's funny. It's fantasy. Again, fantasy not meaning that it doesn't happen, but that it's not about oxen and cows. It's about something much bigger than that. It's about relationships. It's about damages. It's about mominous. It's about obligations to one another. About damages. It's much bigger than an ox and a cow. Now, when people read the Laws of the Ring, Lord of the Rings, or those people who didn't have the patience or the literacy to read it went to the movie, nobody thought that hobbits are hobbits. Nobody went to it thinking, gee, didn't know there were hobbits. Look around, where are the hobbits? Everybody understood. This is fantasy. Well, if it's fantasy, why does everybody go? Why do you want to go to fantasy? And look how popular it's become among children and adults. All of a sudden, the world's taken by fantasy. Why? Is it because we want to escape reality? No, fantasy does something else, and the writers of fantasy, the skillful writers of fantasy, understand it. And that is, your guard is down when you're in the world of fantasy. When you're in the world of hobbits, you don't start thinking, you don't translate it back to yourself, and you don't start making judgments, and you're kind of in another world. So you allow your mind to be played with, and you allow your mind to go along playfully. And the author has an opportunity then to take you into a world and confront you with concepts and ideas at moments that your guard is down. Because if the story is about Mr. Smith and Miss whoever, then right away these are people you recognize, these are situations they recognize, it feels uncomfortably close to home sometimes, and your mind starts making up its decisions and you're closed. You get into the world of fantasy and all of a sudden you're open to anything. You're open to absolutely anything. So it gives the artist, it gives the author or the producer or whoever enormous opportunity to take you to places you wouldn't otherwise be able to go. And in Gemara, the Hagdol, we've got the same kind of an idea. If we open our minds to the fact that we're dealing with concepts, we're dealing with ideas, we're not dealing with objects. So when we're talking about a Kohen in Kodshim, or we're talking about a korban, we're not just talking about a particular individual who's a descendant of Aaron who had a particular role to play in the Beis Hamikdash and brought these sacrifices. That's one level on which it operates. But even if that's not a level that we can relate to on a day-to-day level, Kodshim allows us, that's one of the beauties of Kodshim, it allows us to operate fantastically in the literal sense of the world. It allows us to enter a world that is unfamiliar. Completely unfamiliar. We've never heard of the concepts before, we've never heard of the ideas before, we've never heard of the halachas before, the laws. We've heard bits and pieces of them, but if we haven't been in Kodshim, it's a new world. The world of the Beis HaMikdash is a new world, and it doesn't resemble anything outside of the Beis HaMikdash, unless we get into the deep concepts. So when I talk about playfulness, that's part of what it is. We've got to allow ourselves to enter into this strange world and experience these different relationships between people and things and people and God and different forces and so on. Now the other thing that we need to realize in Kodshim is And this has become easier to relate to coaching now than it has been for a long time. When the world was going through its scientific stage, from I don't know when until probably the 90s, certainly till the end of the 50s, and then to some degree even much later than that, it was much harder to understand coaching. You could deal with coaching mathematically. We've always been able to deal with coaching mathematically. It's very mathematical. It's formulas. It's relationships. It's very, very, the thinking is very mathematical, very, very pure. But conceptually, it's been much harder. Now it's a little easier because the world is much more open to the understanding of energies and how energies work, and to some degree, and that energy exists, and that the worlds of energies are worlds that we need to be cognizant of in different ways. And as we mentioned in other shiurim, part of that's come through the influence of Asian philosophy on the West now. Part of it has come through a disillusionment with Western philosophy and with science, that it hasn't got the full answer, that it's not the total picture. And while people have been reluctant to look at religion, they've moved into spirituality. Spirituality is religion without obligation. That's really what spirituality is. It's religion without mitzvahs. It's all the philosophy, everything without the mitzvahs. Which is not that far off what the Sheva Mitzvahs B'nai Noach. It's not that far different to what religion is meant to be for a non-Jew. Religion for a non-Jew is not to be meant full of ritual. Religion is not meant to be... They don't go to church, according to the Sheva Mitzvahs B'nai Noach. They don't have all the prayer and all that. They've got to believe in God. They've got to not serve idols, mustn't murder. There's seven things they've got to do. That's it. And all the laws associated with those seven. But it's not meant to be institutionalized. It's not meant to be an institutional religion. So the world, the non-Jewish world's move into spirituality is much closer to the Sheva Mitzvahs B'nai Noach, in my opinion, than Christianity's. Where there are elements of Avodah Zarah, and there are elements of ritualistic worship, and there are institutionalization and power organizations and politics. So the disillusionment, there's a simultaneous disillusionment with the world of science and the world of religion. And so people's answers kind of been spirituality. Well, that's coming pretty close to where they're meant to be in God's terms. I found in the time that I spend in India, leaving aside their religious side, which as I've mentioned to you, I wasn't involved in at all, but just the mere philosophic and ethical side of their practices, which is what they're really all about, the closest to Sheva Mitzvahs B'nai Noach that I've ever seen a culture come in terms of what they know and what they believe and what they practice. Very, very close. So in the world generally, there's much more openness to things that are not measurable, to things that are not visible, to things that don't fit into the three dimensions that we're normally comfortable with. And that's Kochim. Kochim is about energies. And we're going to see that right at the beginning of the sugya, because Kochim is the movement of energies. You can't see them. Sometimes you see manifestations of them. Sometimes you don't. But the Kohanim know how to manage those energies and how to use them. So that's what we're going to be looking at. And the particular area that we're going to be looking at is a relatively small sugya that deals with the clothes that the Kohanim used to wear. And that's on Daf Yud Zayin Amud Beis, on 17b of Zvachim. And it's about two-thirds down the page. You'll see the two dots and the words Mechusar Begodim. Those words between the two dots, you'll see two dots before the Mechusu Begodim and two dots after the Mechusu Begodim. Those two words, Mechusu Begodim, come from the Mishnah. And the Mishnah has told us that a Kohen who serves without the proper clothing, Pesulo, the Avoido is Posul, the outcome is invalid. So that's very interesting. Not only is it as if he hasn't kind of performed anything, he's actually had a negative impact on the object of his avodah, of his service. Now if we look at the wording in the Rambam, perhaps we'll start with that so that you get a sense of that. We look at the Rambam in two places always. The one place is on the Sefer HaMitzvahs, where the Rambam defines the mitzvah. So the Sefer HaMitzvahs, this is the same thing we did at the Sunday Shiur in a different sugya. The Sefer HaMitzvahs in positive Mitzvah 33, Mitzvah Lamed Gimel, says, He shenitztavu ha-kohanim, this 33rd positive Mitzvah is that the Kohanim have been instructed Lilbosh begodim meyuchodim, to wear, listen to the Rambam's language carefully, to wear specific clothes, lechovoid ulesiferis, for honor and for majesty. Okay? V'az yavdu b'mikdash, and then they may serve in the mikdash. So this mitzvah is not about serving, it's about serving wearing the right clothing. And he quotes the source of it, which is from our Gemara. And we'll come back to look at this Rambam in greater detail. In the Yad HaZoche, the Rambam says in his halachic work, in Hilchos Klei HaMikdash, the laws of the utensils of the Beis HaMikdash, so we see the Rambam considers the Big Day Kahuna as one of the utensils. That's very important information for us. So the relationship then of the Big Day Kahuna to the Kohen might be a similar relationship to a pan or a pot or whatever was used in the Beis HaMikdash and the particular content of that container and content. So we see that the Rambam putting the laws of the clothes of the Kohen, Klei HaMikdash, the utensils of the Beis HaMikdash, says in the 10th chapter, it's Perek Yud Halacha Dalet, Mitzvahs Aseh La'asos Begodim Elu, after having enumerated the different clothes, he says it is a positive mitzvah to make these clothes, V'liyayos HaKohen Oved Bohen, and for the Kohen to serve wearing these clothes, Shineim, as it says, Basisa Bigdei Kodesh, as it says, he brings the various psukim. The Kohen Godol Sheshimesh Befochos Mishmoyne Begodim Elu, and a Kohen Godol who served in the temple wearing less than his eight clothes, or Kohen Hedyot Sheshimesh Befochos Me'arba Begodim Elu, or a regular Kohen who was wearing less than his four specific clothes, Hu HaNikro Mechusar Begodim, he is called a Mechusar Begodim, lacking in clothes. That's this very phrase of Yerushalayim Gemara, Mechusar Begodim. V'Avodosoi Pesulo, his avoda is posul. So if he's brought a sacrifice, that sacrifice is void. It's been, it can't even be brought again a second time. Nothing can be done. It has to be dispensed with. It's possible. So he can make a sacrifice. You've got a new dimension here. In the kitchen, you can make something trafe if you don't keep the laws of kashrus. In the Beis HaMikdash, there are a whole lot of other things that can make a korban trafe. There's the thought of the kohen. There's the timing. There's the intention. And there's the clothing of the kohen. If he's not wearing the right clothes, the korban is possible. Imagine if we had that law in the kitchen. You know, if you boil a cup of tea or coffee without wearing the right clothes, the coffee's trash. That's the level of stringency and meticulousness that there was in the Beis HaMikdash. So a kohen who served with less than the appropriate clothing is avoid is possible, but more than that, the chayiv miso bidei shamayim. He's also chayiv miso. He's guilty of death, not by a Beis Din, but by God. That's how serious it is. So this is serious. This is something really, for some reason, God regards this as incredibly important. The clothes that the Kohen has to wear. And that is going to lead us into a whole understanding of why, surely in our kind of society, we would tend to say, clothes, that's such an external thing. It should be the least important thing. What's important is his intention. Yes, that's important. What's important is his knowledge and competence. Yes, that's so. What should be important is his piety. Yes, that's so to some degree too. But his clothing? Is his clothing that serious that if he's missing one item of clothing, he's guilty of death? And his korban is possible? Yeah. So now we need to understand why. What is this? Where does this come from? Why would this be so? And in so doing, I believe we're going to be able to explore and understand not only the role of the Kohen's clothing, but the role of clothing. And more important than that, what is clothing really? What is conceptually what is clothing? If I were to ask you to define clothing conceptually, if a shor is not a shor and a porah is not a porah and a bor is not a bor, what are begodim conceptually?
Your first unspoken and widespread proclamation of the world of who you are and how you're relating to them.
So it would be a projection of your personality. It would be a projection of your persona.
It's not undifferentiated, everybody. It's the level where it's not differentiated to who. When I speak to you, it's different than someone else. But my clothing is for...
It stays the same for everybody. Yes. So the way you project who you are to the world would be one one element of clothing. What else is clothing?
It's a difference between who we are and who we might want to be.
Yes, but clothing is sometimes is who we are, sometimes is who we want to be, and sometimes it kind of bridges it. What else?
Perhaps what we think about ourselves, how we value ourselves.
So it represents something which ties a little bit, I think, to what David was saying earlier in terms of what we're projecting to the world about ourselves. I very simply, clothing is the interface between the human body and the environment. That's what clothing is. Clothing is the point of interface, the point of contact. The human being, the human being's point of interface with his environment is his clothing. In your comment, David, about clothing projecting the image of who we are to the world, that's so. What about clothing's capacity to impact inwards, who we are? What happens? It's quite interesting. I always comment in Elizabeth in this Beaton Theatre. There were very little props, weren't there? They were in the old Shakespearean theatre. They weren't big on special effects. What about costume?
Sure, elaborate, right?
The costume was elaborate. So why is that? So you can have theatre without special effects and without the props, but it's hard to have theatre without costume. Why? Any actor can give you the answer to that. In the city of Endless. Yeah, the moment they put that costume on, they transformed. They get into the role when they put that costume on.
They become
the part when they put the costume on. There seems to be a huge impact also from clothing inwards. So clothing is a point of interface with an energy projecting outward. Now, do you see where we get energies? So if by wearing a certain clothing, can I impact the energy in this room by the clothes I come into this room wearing? Sure I can. Each one of us actually impact the energy in the room by all sorts of things. By our being here or not being here impacts the energy of the room. Our body language impacts the energy of the room. Our words, the way what we say impacts the energy of the room. But even what we wear impacts the energy of the room. So clothing is not just about ourselves, it's about the energy we radiate is a combination of what's coming from within us, and the clothes kind of amplify them or distort them or whatever they do. But certainly the clothes can filter the energy that goes out, but it also works the other way around. So clothes seem to have a two-way energy transference capacity. So clothes are not just about, oh, that's just external, that just doesn't mean anything. Clothes, what difference does it make? What's important is who you are, what you are. Wow, no. Clothes are a very powerful transmitter of energy. And colors come into that, and the Feng Shui people will talk to you about colors that are uplifting, and colors that are depressive, and colors that make you optimistic, and colors that... There's a whole science to it, in terms of the energies that clothing, both the style of clothing and the coloring of clothing, puts out to the world, and the energy that it puts into you. So if Kodshim is about energies and sanctity, and we're learning about Big Day Kahuna, which is the interface between, in this case, the Kohen and the world around him, then I think we're going to touch Kabbalistically and conceptually, in addition to the halakhos of the Beis Hamikdash, I think now you get an idea, you begin to get an idea what I mean about having fun with the Kohen. You begin to play with ideas and start seeing, this is big, this is such amazing stuff, and we'll have to see where it takes us.
I mean, in terms of the Kohen, the Kadol is part of the uniform.
Yeah. Well, so uniform is an important thing. Now, here, the whole thing might be uniform.
Yeah, I mean, the baseball player shows up at the stadium one night without his uniform, he's not going out on the field.
Right.
He can hit the ball just as well with or without the uniform, but he's not going out on the field without the uniform. The Kohen Gadol's not going into the Beit HaMikdash without the uniform.
That's so interesting. We would almost then say that the whole concept of uniform probably comes from the Beit HaMikdash. It's probably the first case of formal uniform. Where would we have it before?
I don't know what it's really like before, but it's hard to imagine that there were certainly armies and large nations before the Beit HaMikdash, and I would imagine that there were some dress codes in the Canaanite armies. But
maybe not. Maybe not. Maybe there wasn't a dress code. What's important was that you knew how to use your weapons. So I don't know. Maybe we find that this was one of the, and of course, where do we find the very first time the the elevated role of clothing.
Well, Hashem was the first.
Hashem made clothes for Adam and Chava. Hashem made them. Clothing is not just we have so debased, and the fashion industry understands clothing to some degree, but in general life we've become so casual about the concept, and we have persuaded ourselves that all that's important is to feel comfortable. Clothes are not about feeling comfortable. You want to feel comfortable, go without clothes. That's the most comfortable way to be. Clothes are about not feeling comfortable. Clothes are about energy. It's not about comfort. Comfort is the least of years. If you've got a choice between two pieces of clothing, you'll choose the one that's more comfortable to wear. But that's not what clothing is about. Ties are not comfortable, and jackets are not comfortable, and shoes are not comfortable. If you just look at what we wear, belts around our soul, these are not things that are comfortable. If we want to be comfortable, there would be different ways to do it. So it's not about comfort. What is it about? Is it just a social thing? No, what we're saying is there's some deep divinity in clothing, if we understand it properly, and if we're going to consider clothing as much more than the fashion item that we wear, but as the whole idea of interface between the deepest part of ourselves and that which is outside of ourselves. And in Kabbalah, of course, the idea of clothing goes much further, because in Kabbalah we talk about the body being the clothing of the soul, and the outer soul being the clothing of the inner soul, and the inner soul being clothed by the inner soul, and so it goes in. So every external covering that covers something deeper is the clothing of the thing deeper, or the container of the content. So again, we see that comparison of container and content. It's clothing is something that when you unpeel all the clothing, you're left with a core. And what's the core? God, yeah, Neshama. So it comes up that clothing is everything that protects the divinity, everything that keeps the godliness within us from being overexposed. And our clothing goes much deeper than just our external garments. So there's a fortune that we'll begin to understand, and we'll try and explore from the way that the Gemara deals with it. Let's start a little bit with the Gemara. The first thing the Gemara says, a question you find very, very often after a Mishnah, the word minalon, and it's a question I just love. Imagine a situation, and again, that's why you've got to have a bit of a sense of humor. A rabbi gets up in shul and says, you're not allowed to turn the lights on Shabbos. And somebody says, where do you get that from? Gemara is not afraid to ask that. Every time the Mishnah says something, minalon, where does that come from? Not because we're questioning the authority, but we're trying to understand the reasoning. We're trying to understand the source. How can we understand the concept if we don't understand the origin of the concept? What posuk does it come from? And we will see in this piece of Gemara, probably not yet tonight, but certainly next week, we will see in this piece of Gemara that there's a profound philosophic difference as to whether this idea comes from posuk A or posuk B. There's huge differences in understanding of what it means once we get into an understanding of what the source is. So minalon is not just a technical question, and it's not just a kind of a chutzpahdikah question. It's such an important question, and something we need to be asking ourselves all the time. Minalon, what is the origin of this idea? Where does it come from? What is its source? Because how can you understand an idea if you don't understand its source? And to say the source is the Torah, of course the source is the Torah, that doesn't help me. The source, I want to know where in the Torah. I want to know what parasha in the Torah. What else is being talked about round and about it? What other laws are learned from the same psukim? What other laws are learned from the same words? What hyperlinks are there between this sentence and other sentences of the Torah so that we can understand ramifications of these halakhot? That's what's important to understand. Amar Rabbi Yahu, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Umatu bo mashmed Rabbi Elazar Rabbi Shimon. Rabbi Avua said in the name of Rabbi Yochanan, and some brought it in the name of Rabbi Elazar, in the name of Rabbi Shimon. The Omar Kro, and he brings a posuk. He brings a posuk from Shemos, Sefer Shemos. V'chogarta oisam avnet, and you shall gird them with an avnet, with a girding. What here we have we could do with English. What is it? What is our scroll translated in?
You shall girdle them with a sash.
You shall girdle them with a sash. That's good enough. Aaron uvonov, Aaron and his sons. The chovashto lohem migbois, and you shall place hats upon their heads. V'hoiso lohem kuhuno lechukas olam, And the kahuna will be for them a chukas olam, an eternal chuk. What is a chuk?
Is not immediately understandable.
So normally it's translated as one of the laws of the Torah, which doesn't immediately look like one that is reason or originates from rational reasoning, is what a chok is. What does a chok mean literally? What does the word come from? Chokek, like hakok. What is the word? What is the word? It's engraving.
Oh, right.
Okay.
It's
okay. Yeah, you're right. Yeah, you've got an engraving. And what does engraving mean? Where is it engraved? Where is a chok engraved?
In the tablets.
So the one would be in the rechot, but everything was then everything's a chok. I would suggest a chok is engraved in the universe. That's the way the world operates. Gravity is a chok. Whether you understand it, whether you don't understand it, whether you agree with it or you don't agree with it, whether you want to philosophize about it or you don't, you jump out of the 100th floor of a building, you're going to hit the ground in a sad state of affairs. That's because of something called gravity. It's a chok. So chok is a law of physics. Chok is a law of reality.
Sorry, teva, tabad is the same idea of an imprint. My bear is to mint a coin and nature.
Right, but chok is even more. Chok, because chok, you're kind of chiseling it. Chok is more than just engraved. Engraving, like, delicately, you wouldn't use the word chok. Chok is actually chiseling. Mm-hmm. To chisel something into the very format of reality. So when we talk about a chok, it's a principle. Now, and as I've said to you, now the world's become much more open to the fact that there are laws as firm and indelibly imprinted in the fabric of the universe as the laws of physics are, that cannot be measured, the laws of energy. And culture, we deal with that. The whole of the Torah, we're dealing with that. There are certain chukim that are absolutely part of the Bria. That's the way the world was created. So that word chuk becomes very important.
Can I ask what you mean by an energy that the world, we all agree, exists, but you can't measure it? Do you mean like emotional responses?
Even beyond with the example that we gave with clothing. You can walk into the room, and because of the clothing, there's a different energy. People feel you're radiating something. That's an energy.
Einstein's law, everything is energy. It's
and just in physics, and the beauty of Einstein is that he really almost gets to the interface of the spiritual and the physical. He came so close to being, if not actually there, that interface, at the point where science kind of begins to meld into metaphysics and into spirituality. But those are as real as the things that we can touch and feel. And if you're sensitive, you can touch and feel them.
Matter is just energy in a different form.
Yep. And that's why Olam Habo is just this world in an energy form instead of in a material form. So when you no longer have a body, you don't need the material form of it. You see it all, you experience it all as energies, because you are energy, the neshama is energy. So when you're talking about energies, you're really talking about interacting at the neshama level. When you're talking about the more substantial part of physics, you're talking about the body's interface with the world. And the Torah spans it all. It includes it all. Now, the Gemara makes an interesting deduction from that sentence. Bizman shebigdehem alehem. That means, says the Gemara, when their clothes are on them, kahunosom alehem. Their kahuno is on them. Ein bigdehem alehem. If their clothes are not on them, Ein kuhunosom aleihem. Their kuhuno is not on them. So again, the verse says, you shall put the sash over them, and you shall put hats on them. V'hoiso lohem kuhuno lechukal, and that will be their kuhuno as a chok forever. So what is the chok? The chok is the clothes make the kohen. But without the clothes, he isn't a kohen. Now that doesn't mean he doesn't have the genetic makeup of a kohen. He has the DNA of a kohen. But he can't function as a kohen. It doesn't work. The circuits don't work. There's some things he can do. He might be able to duchen and shul. Might be able to be called up kohen to the Sefer Torah because he is genetically a kohen. But his ability, his capacity to function as a kohen, is impaired without the clothes. It doesn't work. It just doesn't work. I just want to go further in the Rashi first, and then we can take a question. V'hoiso lohem, the third last line in the Rashi. V'hoiso lohem halevisho hazos, and this wearing of the clothes is, this in itself is kahuna. That is the kahuna. Alma, so we see, says Rashi, kahunosom teluyo bevigdehem. Now we're getting really far into the idea of clothes. Not only are clothes not just in something external and so on, but it impacts the kohen. That's the example that I gave you earlier when we first started talking about clothes, and we talked about clothes as projecting who you are. But clothes can also, at times, the kohen being one of them, and the baseball example, Hagel being another one, the kohen defines who you are. The clothing defines who you are. Not only does it project who you are, it defines who you are. And without the right clothing, you're not that person. And if you're not wearing clothes, then what are you? And Rashi says an incredible thing. Haveluhu zorim. Then you're a non-kohen. Now what happens if a non-kohen brings a korban? It's misa, it's not good news. Uvezar ashkechon de machil avodah. And a zar is machalil the avodah. He makes the avodah possible. So it's not the clothing that does it. The clothing makes you know ois kohen. If you're ois kohen, what are you? You're a zar. A zar is worked from the base of Mikdash. It's Chayim Misa, and a zar is worked from the base of Mikdash. Avidos Apsula. That's the reasoning that we can. So look at the power of the clothes, at least as far as the Kohen is concerned. Now, much later in the Sugi, we're going to get into the question of, are we just fantasizing when we try and draw parallels from that to our clothing and to other forms of interface? Or are there grounds to do that? We'll have to, is this really just very exclusive to the base of Mikdash? And it applies only within the walls of the Beis HaMikdash? Or are the universal principles that we're beginning to touch on over here applicable to day-to-day life? That we're going to see much further on in the sugya. But right now, let's assume yes, until proved otherwise. The Torah is teaching us these things, not just, you don't only learn Kochim if you're planning to become a Kohen. You learn Kochim as part of Torah. You learn Kochim as part of Torah. We're told all of Torah has to be made relevant. Everything we learn should be to take outside right after the shir and start practicing. Well, what are we going to do with Big Day Kohanah? So clearly the intention is that all parts of Torah are able to be internalized and used as a way of managing our lives and managing the world. So our assumption at this point, unless we're going to be proved otherwise, is that these are principles that don't only apply to the Kohen, and we need to understand them. But we've seen something quite radical already. We've seen that the clothes are crucial, that they're not only crucial as a condition for avodah, they're crucial as a condition for being a kohen. It's in the gavra, it's not in the action, it's in the subject, in the human being. That a person without the appropriate clothes is not the appropriate person. Now how far we can take that idea, we'll have to explore. What does that mean? A judge is not wearing judge clothes, a rabbi is not wearing rabbi clothes, a teacher is not wearing teacher clothes. How far do we take this? But the concept that is being thrown at us is that there are situations, at least, when wearing the wrong clothing invalidates the persona. You're not the right person in the wrong clothes. It's not that you're the right person, you're just not dressed appropriately. It's not a question. You're not dressed appropriately, you're not the right person. How can that be? Clothing is just an external wrapping. What difference does it make? No, clothing is a transmitter of energy. Transmitter of energy from the individual to the world, and it's a transmitter of energy from the world to the individual. It's a filtering process. It filters. It filters who you are, what message you're putting out to the world. When you're clothed, the world only sees some of you. And so you're filtering what the world experiences of you. And when you're clothed, you only experience some of the world. You're filtering. Now, in the physical sense, that means you're filtering cold out. You're filtering certain sunlight out. You're filtering certain physical forces. But you're also filtering certain spiritual forces, emotional forces. How so?
Modesty.
Well, modesty would be one, but even simpler than that. What is the filtering process that takes place by clothes? What is power dressing about?
Looking apart.
And for what purpose? What are you doing with that?
Projecting a certain image.
So part of it is projecting out, but also what's happening is the way people respond to you. So people are not going to respond as openly to you necessarily. If you are in an intimidating setting, you're not going to find people being open with you. People are going to be more respectful, or they're going to feel intimidated, or whatever it's going to be. So your clothing filters. That's not a bad thing. That's inevitable. Your clothing filters. The question is only you choose what to filter. So when you're choosing your clothes in the morning, now this becomes a major mission. once we start getting an understanding of what clothing is, deciding what I'm going to wear today becomes something really important, because I'm deciding what I'm, of me I'm filtering to the world, and I'm deciding what of the world I'm filtering to me, because the world is going to respond differently to me depending on what I wear, and I'm going to respond differently to the world depending on what I wear. Now, what does my day look like today? Where am I, what do I want? What do I want to do? And how do I make sure that it's still authentically me? Kohen is still authentically a Kohen. If you take a Yisrael and dress him up like a Kohen, it's like taking a chimpanzee and dressing him up like a Kohen. He doesn't become a Kohen. Clothes can't transform you from what you are not to something different. Clothes can only filter the energy you're sending out and the energy you're getting back.
That's what the Pasuk says,
you say, why?
That's why.
Yes, the Chovet of the Sephardim is going to become very important in Daf Yud Tes Amud Aleph. The idea of the Chovet of the Sephardim, exactly how we use it, and back in the Rambam we use it. But you're right, the idea is already there. The Rambam makes the point that in the Kohen's case, they're not to have any personal benefit from the clothes. It's not for their own Chovet of the Sephardim. Because what is the real key of the Kohen? A Kohen is not an originator of energies. When a Kohen duchens, whose energy is it? Why does the Shliach Tzibur say Yivarechecho, and then the Kohen says Yivarechecho? Hashem, Hashem, Vishmerecho, Vishmerecho. Because he hasn't got a siddur? Is that why? Because the Kohen might not know the Brocha? Is that the reason we do it? No, that's not the reason we do it. The reason we do it, it's brought that the Shliach Tzibur, with the entire community, provides energy to the Kohen, which the Kohen reflects back to the community.
It's a transponder.
It's a transponder, that's exactly what it is. The Kohen is a transmitter of energy, not a generator of energy. And we find that in many places. So, for example, where does the Kohen get his energy from in the Beis HaMikdash? What's the transmission process? Where is he transmitting from?
The Kohen? First
the Kodesh?
His clothing?
The floor of the Beis HaMikdash.
My spirit?
Yes. If he's wearing shoes, avodas pesulim. Same thing. No transmission. So if you can now think of energy coming from the Kodesh Kedoshim through the floor of the Beis HaMikdash. Imagine what one could do with special effects in a movie. You've got these things, this energy coming through the floor of the Beis HaMikdash, up through the feet of the Kohen. Now there must be no chatzitzas between him and the korbanos, and the kelim have to be the right kelim, so that energy can be properly transmitted. Now you start seeing where the clothing comes in. So now the clothing can either inhibit that process, or the clothing can be part of that transmission process. But the kohen, as we begin to understand more of him, is a transmitter of energy. He's not a generator of energy. In most cases, people generate energy. Human beings are the only real generators of energy. We can create energy. We don't just transmit energy. We don't just transform. We create energy all the time. The human being is not a consumer of energy. He's a creator and energizer. We'll have other opportunities to discuss that. Whereas every other part of the Bria is a consumer of energy. The Kohen, the specific role of the Kohen is not to generate new energy. It's to transmit energy of the Beis HaMikdash to the world. And he does that through the Avodah. So yes, we're getting into the world of energies, we're getting into the world of spirituality, we're getting into the world of special effects, we're getting into the world of fantasy, and at the same time dealing with some very serious halachas, and very meticulous and detailed halachas in the process, and that's the interface that we're talking about.
What's the deal with Ashveros wearing the Kohen's clothing? Was he a fool, or
not at all. He realized the power of the clothing, but he didn't realize is that it doesn't work
because
it's a transmitter. Yeah, it's a transmitter of an energy that has to come through the Beis HaMikdash, through the Kohen. It's not the clothes.
It's necessary, not a sufficient condition.
Mm-hmm. It's a they are covered with tiferes. They're glorious clothes, but they don't. Their power lies not in their glory, but in what they're glorifying. And they're not there to glorify the wearer. They're there to glorify the energy that the Ribbono Shel Olam transmits through the Beis HaMikdash. That's really it. So you begin to see how you can have fun with Kochim. We can have fun with Kochim, and I hope that we will as we go forward.
Next one, sir.